Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown. The healthcare debate is intensifying in Washington and elsewhere, and President Obama will be on in primetime on television tonight to push his healthcare reform plans. But even if a bill passes, will that legislation cure the fundamental flaws in our healthcare system? My guest this hour says maybe not. He's Dr. Arnold Relman, Professor Emeritus at Harvard Medical School, former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, and author of a book called A Second Opinion, Rescuing America's Healthcare, in which he outlines his perspective on the healthcare problem and the cure for it. Dr. Relman, thank you for being on Open Line today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Charlene. Glad to be part of your discussion.
What's your impression of what you're seeing so far in Washington as the plans are debated and legislation is being worked on to change our healthcare system?
Well, what I see is an enormous amount of confusion and conflicting vested interests contending for advantage. And the essential problem of American healthcare is being overlooked. And I'm a little unhappy, a little pessimistic about the chances of a good bill emerging from this Congress that will really deal with the problem that we have to solve.
What would you consider the essentials for a good bill to change our healthcare system?
One, we have to get rid of, in some way or another, the private insurance system and have a unified, tax-supported, single-payer type of insurance system. Two, we have to change the delivery of health care, the way medical care is organized and delivered, so that there are not inappropriate incentives for continuing to make medical care into a big profit-making business, which it is now. And three, we have to have some courageous leadership in Washington which is willing to tell the truth to the people. It's really a very simple issue, and it's being obscured by lobbyists with vested interests and by a lot of people who don't really understand what the real problem is. The real problem is that we have a healthcare system that's been turned into a gigantic business, and this business is intent on generating more and more income for the providers, for the owners, for the investors, and for the doctors. And until we change that system, we're not going to be able to afford to have health care for everybody.
Your book goes into a lot of the background on how we came to the point where healthcare is a business instead of more, as you put it, a social service.
Yes.
Talk about how and when things started to turn into that direction.
Well, it really started not long after World War II, when huge amounts of new money began to go into paying for healthcare. We had, first of all, the expansion of private employment-based insurance with lots and lots of working people becoming insured who hadn't been insured before. And then in 1966, we had the passage of Medicare and Medicaid, which began to pour a huge amount of federal money into health care. And then investors and businessmen who had started the short order food chains and saw a tremendous opportunity for profit began to go into health care, and insurance companies that had never gone into the medical insurance business before began to form themselves into businesses, investor-owned businesses. So in the 1970s, we had, for the first time in American history, and for the first time anywhere in the world, we had investors going into the healthcare business. And healthcare was gradually turned into a huge medical industrial complex. Right now, I would estimate that almost a half of all the money we spend on health care, and that's now around $2.5 trillion, almost half of that money goes to investor-owned businesses and to all sorts of for-profit organizations that feed off of the healthcare system. No wonder nobody wants to see a change now.
Well, yeah, because you're saying that we have all these corporations that are making lots and lots of money off
yes.
it, so why would they want to change
exactly.
it? There's a lot of talk about efficiency and inefficiency in our healthcare system. What is it that is inefficient about American healthcare?
We're spending a huge amount of money doing things that may not be necessary and sometimes may even be harmful. And
Can you give us examples of these kinds of things, Dr. Relman?
Well, the use of expensive imaging techniques, MRIs and CAT scans, for example, tens and tens of billions of dollars are being spent everywhere through the healthcare system. And much of the time, these tests are not necessary. They can be replaced by very simple, less expensive clinical methods that will get you the same information. Now, sometimes these tests are very valuable and are absolutely essential to get at the diagnosis, but analysis by experts, it's not just my opinion, but by many experts who looked at it, draw the conclusion that probably at least 30% 40% of all the diagnostic services and elective services that doctors and hospitals and diagnostic centers provide are unnecessary. And that's waste. That's inefficient. If we could get rid of that, we would save hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And the only way to get rid of that is to change the incentives. Right now, hospitals and doctors and diagnostic clinics and all sorts of medical services make money the more they do. The more tests they do, the more services they provide, the more money they make.
But if we change the system, then you're still going to have companies that are objecting because that cuts them out. Like if we're using fewer MRIs, then the companies that make and maintain and promote MRIs are going to lose money, and they're not going to let that happen.
Well, they're not going to like it, but American industry is very resilient. It goes where the money is, and the money that we save on unnecessary and duplicated medical services will be spent elsewhere. And I think that we have to ask ourselves whether 80% or 85% of the American economy and American businesses should be held captive by the 15 to 20% that are making money from health care. I don't think that's reasonable. And I think we have to have political leadership courageous enough to face that problem and make the necessary adjustments. And people ought to understand what the issues are.
Do you think that consumer understanding is part of the problem? For example, as a patient, a consumer of healthcare services, you don't know whether the test your doctor is ordering is precautionary, necessary, or something that's optional that, you know, hey, let's just do this because it's our procedure in this company.
Yes, and the insurance covers it.
Right.
Yes, that's precisely the point. People are more or less dependent on the judgments of their doctors. I'm all for patients participating as much as possible in the decisions about their own health care. I do not believe in medical paternalism, that all the time doctors always know best and should always control what is done. I think patients have to participate and they have to be informed. But I'm experienced enough to know that when you're sick, when you're really sick or injured, you depend critically on the advice of your physician. If you don't believe this physician, you have to go to some physician. You have to depend on what physicians advise you to do. And when the physician's livelihood depends on how many tests and how many services and how many expensive drugs and so on that you're being provided, you cannot expect anything but what we have, namely overuse, overly generous use of medical resources to feed the needs of the investors and the vested interests in our health care system.
One of the issues about this whole thing that's in our newspaper, the Columbus Dispatch today, has to do with physicians actually being laid off by the companies. This one is about a doctor who joined Mount Carmel Health System here 5 years ago, figuring he could save money on rent and liability insurance and so on. So he takes his practice to Mount Carmel. Well, then all of a sudden the company informs him, sorry, we don't need you anymore. So doctors are losing their jobs. Talk about how doctors are affected by all of this and how they play a role in changing all of this.
Well, doctors are absolutely crucial in how the healthcare system is going to be reformed. Most of the money that we spend on healthcare is made as a result of decisions or recommendations or opinions given by doctors. Doctors are mainly responsible for what we spend. We have to have a system, Charlene, in which doctors are paid, and they should be paid well and fairly, for giving us the benefit of their best advice without any consideration of whether the advice at that moment is going to add to their income. In other words, the fee-for-service system has to be replaced by a system in which doctors work for salaries. And they have to work for not-for-profit, multi-specialty group practices like the Cleveland Clinic or the Mayo Clinic or Kaiser Permanente or Marshfield or Geisinger. There are lots and lots of these, of course, are very big organizations. I envision in the system that we need lots of small, community-based, multi-specialty group practices in which doctors are paid salaries for working together to give you the best care that medical information suggests and that and the care that patients want. And the whole system should be supported by a fair, progressive health care tax. Everybody must contribute to this tax, just as everybody has to contribute to the costs of the, in a town or a city of education. Everybody has to contribute according to their means, and the total amount of money that that tax collects would determine the total amount of money that our society wants to spend on health care. In my opinion, Charlene, I think the evidence is very clear. We're spending plenty of money now. We don't need more money. It's a myth to imagine that in order to cover everybody, we've got to spend lots more money. We don't need lots more money. We're spending more than enough money now. We're spending more than twice as much as most other advanced countries that have good health care systems that cover everybody. We don't need more money. The problem in the United States is not that was is not lack of money, it's that we have a bad system. And whatever problems these other countries have, you hear a lot of objections about government-supported health care. Look at the waiting lists and the rationing and so on. A lot of that, of course, is exaggeration and is myth. But there are waiting lists and there are some shortages. That's because these other countries don't spend nearly as much money as we do. If Canada, for example, spent as much money or almost as much money as we do on health care, they'd have the best health care system in the world. No waiting lists, no shortages, and everybody would be very happy. Most of them are happy now, but they'd be happier.
But the criticism in Canada, of Canada and some of the other countries is that even though you might get good care when it's something basic like a cold or a sprained ankle, the problem comes in when you have, say, cancer and you need extensive treatment and there's a lot of testing and a lot that goes into that kind of care and you have a longer wait and maybe not as good an outcome in that system.
Yeah, Charlene, a lot of that, those claims are simply apocryphal. They're rumors, and if you look at the data, and I've spent a lot of time studying the Canadian healthcare system and the United Kingdom healthcare system, but particularly I know a lot about Canada because I've visited it many, many times, met with doctors and community organizations and with government officials. Essential, important medical care is almost always available. It's the elective procedures for which there is a wait and some restriction. But I repeat what I said before. Any problem that Canada or any other country with universal health care might have in providing needed medical services to everybody would be dispelled if they spent a little more money. Their problem is money. Our problem is we have a terrible system.
Okay, and you're saying that we would do well to imitate at least some aspects of the way Canada or the UK does it.
Yes, only some aspects. We cannot adopt wholesale the healthcare system in any other country. We are the United States. We have our own culture, our own traditions, and we have to develop a healthcare system that's right for us. But one of the things we can learn from Canada is that it is right for the government to assume responsibility for providing health care for everybody, and that everybody ought to participate in paying the costs. And when you do that, it's much cheaper.
We're talking to Dr. Arnold Relman. He is a former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, a professor emeritus at Harvard Medical School, and he is the author of a book called A Second Opinion, Rescuing America's Healthcare. If you have a question for Dr. Relman, give us a call at 292-8513 or send an email to openline@wosu.org. And in fact, Dr. Relman, we have an email from a listener named Doug, who says, isn't it true that the profit motive has been practically eliminated in every other industrialized country other than the U.S. when it comes to health care?
Well, Doug, it's certainly true that the profit motive is much less a factor in determining what health care is provided in other countries than in the U.S. It is certainly true that there's no other country in the world in which investors' interests and the profit motive is so important as in the United States.
And talk about we're talking about reforming the system. Looking at what you know of the legislation that's working its way through Congress now, do you see enough provisions to get away from that profit motive? No,
unfortunately, I don't. I'm very sympathetic with the desire of the Obama administration and the Democratic majority in Congress to expand coverage to the almost 50 million people who don't have insurance now, and to help the many other millions who have insurance but are not adequately covered and would go broke if they really had a major illness. I'm very sympathetic and supportive of the desire to expand coverage, and that's what most of the legislation that's now percolating through the various committees in Congress is designed to do. But what I find very disappointing is that there is no appropriate initiative, no effort to control the continuing expansion of health care costs. They're worried about how to pay right now, up front, for the increased cost of covering all these additional 50 million people. And there are various proposals of ways of doing that. And as you know, there's a lot of argument about what's the best way to do it. But nobody talks about how we're going to control, at least talks realistically, about how we're going to control the continuing inflation. In the next 10 years, the cost of health care will almost double if inflation, the health cost inflation, continues to rise. And all the proposals that have been mentioned, like more preventive medicine and comparative effectiveness studies and more primary care and electronic records keeping, are good ideas and will improve the quality of health care, but most experts, including the Congressional Budget Office, believe that there is very little to reason to believe that any of these things will greatly slow down the rise in increased health care costs. That rise is due to the incentives of a fee-for-service system and a basically profit-oriented system heavily committed to new technology and expensive new techniques all the time without regard to what really would be useful. So we've got to tackle that head on. And I don't see any realistic confrontation on the part of the Obama administration of that problem. The person who comes closest to identifying that problem in the administration is Peter Orszag, who is the director of the Office of Management and Budget, used to be the CBO director. He's a very smart economist. He knows what the problem is, but he thinks that government regulation can solve it. I've met with him and discussed this with him, and I've tried, I think unsuccessfully, to persuade him that the only way to change this is to change the behavior of doctors and hospitals. And that's going to require a lot of thought and a lot of reorganization.
And do you think it will require more time than the deadline that has been set by the Obama administration?
Yes, I do. I think that as bad as things are now in our health care system, and goodness knows they're very bad, that things are going to have to get still worse, and the costs are going to have to become intolerable. And the majority of American businessmen who are not in the healthcare field, who are now having to pay more and more for the healthcare costs of their employees, are going to feel the pain even more, and the medical profession is going to have to realize that they have to participate in designing a new system. Now, the AMA, to my surprise and delight, seems to be agreeing that changes are necessary, but they're very cautious and they're very tentative about what kind of changes they're willing to accept. But change will, the handwriting is on the wall, Charlene. The handwriting is on the wall. There's nothing that will stop the inevitable rise of health care costs except reorganization of the healthcare system, of the way we practice medicine and the way we pay doctors and hospitals.
All right. Dr. Relman, we're going to have to break away for a moment, but we'll continue our discussion in a moment, and you can join in our conversation about healthcare with Dr. Arnold Relman. Give us a call at 292-8513 or send an email to openline@wosu.org. This is WOSU 820 Columbus.
WOSU News reports on the stories you need to hear and the stories you want to hear.
The Audubon Society has designated this location as an important bird area.
Audubon could have chosen to put this nature center many other places, but the reason we picked downtown Columbus was we can really inspire people.
Get more from your news with the award-winning WOSU News Team on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and Classical Music.
Good morning, and thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. I'm Amy Jurevich, currently 68 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:30. Stay right here in 30 minutes at noon for fresh air. Judge Apatow is the director of the comedies Knocked Up and The 40-Year-Old Virgin, and he has written and directed a new film called Funny People. It stars Apatow's former roommate Adam Sandler as a comedy star diagnosed with an incurable blood disorder. Seth Rogen plays an aspiring comic who becomes his assistant. That and much more on Fresh Air, beginning at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Bexley, offering graduate programs in Christian ministry, theology, youth and family, church and ethics, preparing leaders for a vocation, not just a job. TrinityLutheranSeminary.edu.
Rain off and on throughout the day today and a high right around 73. Rain likely tonight as well. And now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown. We're talking with Dr. Arnold Relman, who is the author of a book called A Second Opinion, Rescuing America's Healthcare, about what does need to change to bring about the reforms that we need in healthcare in this country. Dr. Relman, you said you don't think this is achievable within the time limit that President Obama has set, getting it done before the August recess.
No, I think that's quite unlikely.
But in the meantime, we have more and more Americans who are losing their health care coverage, many who have been without health care coverage for a long time, and people who are going into bankruptcy paying for their portion of medical costs that they've incurred for a catastrophic illness. What are we supposed to do for those people while we're waiting for Congress to work out a better plan?
Whatever we can. It's a very bad situation, Charlene, and there's no quick and easy solution until and unless the Congress is willing to grasp the nettle and do what's necessary to change the system. And we can't change the system effectively until everybody, particularly Congress, understands what the real problem is. And what is discouraging to me is at the moment, they don't seem to understand what the real problem is. Or if they grasp, as some of them seem to, and as an increasing number of commentators in the media seem to be grasping, the idea that rising costs must be controlled, they don't understand how that can be done. And what I'm saying is, doctors have to be involved. One of the chapters in my book, the last chapter in my book, is called An Open Letter to My Colleagues in the Medical Profession, in which I say to doctors, this time, doctors, you have to be part of the solution and not part of the problem. You have to step up and understand what the options are and begin to propose constructive ways to solve the problem. I don't think the AMA, which of course doesn't represent more than a minority of doctors right now, I don't think the AMA is quite prepared to do that. But polls show that in general, doctors are beginning to understand, a majority of doctors say that they realize major change is necessary. I hope that's a good sign.
All of us can only hope. We have a call from Ken right now, Dr. Relman. Let's talk to Ken. Hi, Ken. You're on Open Line.
Hello, Dr. Relman. I really appreciate your what you had to say about the medical profession as a whole. And being a retired person myself, I can understand some of the healthcare costs that come across. Also, one of the things that I have found an interest in over the last, I think it's about 10 years or so, that Oregon is one state, I believe, that has established a pretty good system in which they have actually set out and forced certain priorities in medical care in looking at that. And it seems to me one of the ways of addressing the cost that we have to look to as the people themselves is how do we set the priorities? I mean, should, you know, like Oregon has done, establish some priorities and saying we're going to only allow certain procedures to be done. If you're older, you don't qualify. If you're younger, you do. Mm. It seems to me that as we as a people need to take on these responsibilities also. And Oregon, I think, has done a pretty good job of trying to establish that.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on that?
Well, Ken, what you're describing in Oregon was an attempt really to ration health care. And the rationing only applied to poor people. To people who were dependent on Medicaid and state support. I didn't think that was a fair basis for rationing. But let me come to the point. I don't think that rationing should even be discussed right now. It isn't necessary if we had an efficient system. We're spending $2.5 trillion on health care now. there is a lot of evidence, and I outline it in my book, and many other analysts have done similar analyses. There is a lot of evidence that if we had a more efficient system, we could get the same amount of health care that we get now for at least one-third at lower cost. There's that much waste and inefficiency in the system. Mm. Well, that one-third is about $800 billion. That would be more than enough to cover everybody and to provide them with all the health care services that's medically justified. Mm. My final point, Kent, is this, that the use of health care resources, what we should do for patients, what we should spend our money on, should be a professional decision, not made by government bureaucrats or insurers, but a professional decision made together with patients who practice in a not-for-profit system without any inappropriate incentives for making money themselves, and who are given a budget to live by. And this is the way many not-for-profit healthcare groups now work. They have a budget. That's how much money they have, and they give their clients, their members, the best possible health care for the money that's available. Mm. I say there's plenty of money to take good care of everybody in the United States right now. We don't need to ration.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for your call, Ken. We also have an email from Valerie. Valerie says, I have relatives who live in Canada and have had significant health concerns over the years, including cancer, and their medical care has always been excellent. They get the treatment they need when they need it. My mother, who lived in the States, and my aunt, who lives in Canada, both developed breast cancer at the same time. My aunt's care was far superior to my mother's, she says, and my aunt has survived her cancer, whereas my mom succumbed to hers. I believe my aunt received better care and treatment for her cancer than my mother did. Can you comment on that, Dr. Relman?
Well, that's a nice story, and it supports the idea that I've already proposed, namely that health care in Canada is good and could be better if they spent more money, but health care in Canada is good, and it makes the point that in this country, health care is distributed largely according to ability to pay. I've spoken to lots and lots of Canadians in all walks of life in Canada. They think that's terrible. They think that's immoral. They wouldn't change their health care system to make it like America's, which depends on ability to pay. And we have to change our system.
And can you talk a little bit about how the profit motive affects how the doctor treats their patients or kind of the ethics with which they approach their patients versus the way it used to be before the commercialization of health care?
Well, I don't want to suggest that before commercialization occurred in the 40s, and I started to practice medicine in the late 1940s. And I've observed this change personally. And I don't want to say that it was all just right before the medical industrial complex came into being. There were certainly doctors who were motivated by incentives to make money, but most doctors did not expect to get rich. My classmates in medical school and my medical students back in the 50s and early 60s went into medicine primarily because they thought it was an honorable, rewarding profession, which would give them a decent living, but they didn't expect to get rich. They wanted the satisfaction of taking good care of patients. Of course, they had to make a living from their practice, and fee-for-service was a reasonable way to do it in those days. But at the present time, fee-for-service is an anachronism because there's so much money involved now, and there's so many opportunities to get rich that doctors have been influenced. And what has happened now is that you have lots and lots of options for diagnosing and treating disease, some of which are efficient and relatively less expensive, and others that are less efficient and much more expensive. And sometimes you just don't know for sure which is what is the best thing to do. And when there are powerful economic incentives, when you make a lot more money by choosing one option over another, it's natural, it's human nature that you're going to do what will increase your income. So I would say it's not the doctor's fault, it's the system's fault. It's the system that gives doctors inappropriate incentives. At the Mayo Clinic, at the Cleveland Clinic, doctors are paid a salary. And they don't make any more money if they do 5 operations in a week or 4 operations in a week or 2 operations. They're paid according to their contributions to the group's effort to provide good care. And the quality of care given by such clinics is excellent. And in general, there's a lot of evidence that they're much more efficient, that they don't waste money doing unnecessary things because they have no incentive. They have lots of patients to take care of, and the doctors are paid a salary, and they're expected to be good, and they watch each other carefully to make sure that they're performing according to the highest standards.
And so that model, you're saying, could be applied nationally.
Yes, I would like to see lots of not-for-profit, multi-specialty, prepaid group practices smaller than the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic all over the country. Primary care doctors should be working side by side with specialists and nurse practitioners and physician's assistants and all the other ancillary help we need in order to provide the best possible care that fits in with the budget that they have to work with. And what I'm saying is that budget could be so generous, considering all the money we spend on health care, if we eliminated the waste, could be so generous that there'd be no need to worry about rationing and underserving.
Okay. We have a call now from Delbert. Hello, Delbert. You're on Open Line.
Yes, I was going to make the statement. I noticed a lot of the naysayers say that what a nationalized health care would do to small business, but I'm of the opinion that if we had a nationalized health care, the small business would be better off because they would be able to keep better people, because a lot of people leave small companies that don't have health care to go to places where they do have health care. And another statement I wanted to make, it seems like it's the Republicans that keep fighting everything. And the whole 8 years they were in there, they never tried to put a health care program together whatsoever. And the last one we had was under Bill Clinton's when Hillary tried to do something. And then when the Republicans had their turn, they didn't try to do anything. And now they're just being naysayers about everything.
Okay.
And they always, one more thing, they always bring up Canada. But I heard one day on the news, on the History Channel, that Sweden has one of the best health care programs in the world. So why don't they follow that model?
All right. Delbert, let's let Dr. Relman respond to you.
Well, okay. Delbert, I have to agree with most of what you say, except I think that America has to develop, the U.S. has to develop its own health care system that's right for our traditions and our culture and our history. We don't have to follow anybody else, except we should adopt the general principle that health care is basically a right of all citizens and that the government should ensure that people get the health care they need. And I think that if we did that, we would find, if we accept community responsibility for supporting health care for all, we'd be much better off than we are now. And I agree with you.
Delbert, thank you for your call. We have an email from Cynthia. Cynthia says, I have two questions. Firstly, to overhaul the method of healthcare delivery, don't we have to start with the very beginning? That is, how medical schools are run. Young doctors amass huge amounts of debt. The pharmaceutical industry is pervasive in doctors' educations. Secondly, what is the percentage of doctors who are part or complete owners of laboratories? So, two parts to Cynthia's question, Dr. Relman.
Part one, Cynthia, yes, you're right. We have to change a lot about the way we teach medicine to emphasize the right things, and I agree with you on that. The pharmaceutical industry should have nothing to do, zero to do with the education of doctors. As they do now, they provide a lot of support to medical schools to help with their education, particularly their graduate and their continuing medical education. That's wrong. That's immoral. The profession ought to be responsible for itself. Secondly, medical students should, I think, get scholarships from the government if they are willing to give year for year national service after they graduate before they go off to follow their own career. I agree with you. It's wrong to have medical students graduate with huge debts because that drives them into looking for ways to make money quickly. The other point, what was Cynthia's other point?
The second part of her question is what percentage of doctors are part or complete owners of laboratories?
I don't know that question, Cynthia, but let me assure you it's common and it's much greater than it should be. I don't think anybody has any hard numbers for that. But the extent to which doctors invest in the services that they prescribe, in the diagnostic services and the drugs and the equipment that they use, and the extent to which doctors have a vested interest in that is, I think, much too large. It's disgraceful. It ought to be something that doctors should be prevented from doing.
Our next email says, isn't it true that there need to be various cultural changes along with any fundamental changes to the healthcare system? Examples, Americans want a quick fix for all of their problems, pills instead of lifestyle changes. Our listener says, Americans don't deal well with end-of-life issues, keep testing and operating until the very end of life, even when there is no hope of extending life. That's an interesting issue to bring up, the end-of-life issues, Dr. Relman.
Yes, well, those are real problems. I don't have any quick and easy solutions for them. But let me just say one thing. A lot has been made about the large amount of money, Medicare expenditures, at the end of life. A large percentage of Medicare expenditure goes for paying for care during the last few months of life. And the implication is that that's unnecessary money. It's money being thrown away for futile attempts to prolong terminal illnesses. Well, that's exaggerated, and in part that's not true. Listeners have to remember that people usually are sick for a long time before they die. Of course, sudden death is common, but it's also very common to be sick for a long time before you finally die. And during that time, it's often not entirely clear whether you're going to die within 3 months, 6 months, a year, 5 years, or 10 years. And doctors and patients want to do the best they can to stave off their death. And until it becomes absolutely clear that it's useless, I don't see anything wrong with spending money when you're sick with a serious illness, which might kill you, but might not.
Even when the person is on Medicare and their care is being funded by the taxpayers.
Absolutely. It's a community responsibility.
What about the other half of the question, that Americans want a quick fix for all of their problems, pills instead of lifestyle changes?
Yes, well, that's a long story. We don't have time to discuss that in detail, but the pharmaceutical industry has to bear some responsibility here. The pharmaceutical industry is promoting all sorts of medications, usually expensive medications, for treating all sorts of conditions that are just part of the stresses and strains of ordinary life, depression and unhappiness and premenstrual tension and all sorts of things that people used to be able to deal with without pills. And now we are being told that there's a pill for every ailment. And, of course, that suits the pharmaceutical industry. But the evidence that these pills really help or make a difference is often lacking, and it's a great source of unnecessary expenditures. We're spending, for people over the age of 65, about 20% of the cost of health care comes from prescription medications. Now, some of that is perfectly justified and necessary and useful, but a lot of that isn't.
Our next email is from Mary, and she sort of continues along these same lines. Mary says, who determines what treatment is medically justified? If we're to get the best possible health care, shouldn't the doctor determine what is medically justified? She says, it sounds to me like your guest is saying the treatment would be determined by someone else based on the diagnosis and not what the doctor thinks needs to be done. Mary says, I can see the doctor wanting to get an MRI, but since the diagnosis says it's not needed, the patient can't get the MRI because it won't be paid for. How is this the best possible care?
Mary, the diagnosis is made by the doctor, not by the government or by the insurer. The doctor's responsibility is to determine the diagnosis and to use the best available evidence in consultation with the patient to choose the most reasonable treatment. And that's what I advocate. Decisions on the use of healthcare resources should be made by doctors and their patients, not by insurers, not by government officials. And the diagnosis is not something that's handed down by the insurer or by the government. That diagnosis should be made and is made by the doctor.
So it was Mary misunderstanding what you have said so far about that?
Maybe she has, because I never intended to imply that the doctor would have to follow orders from some third party. Healthcare is a matter between doctors and their patients. And the third parties, government, and the people who pay for healthcare should decide only how much they're willing to pay for healthcare on a national insurance basis. That is a public decision. How much do we want to spend on health care? And then it should be up to the doctors with their patients to decide how best to use that money. What I've said, and I repeat, there's plenty of money. Don't worry about the shortage of money or that the doctors would have to cut down on needed care. If we had an efficient system, there's plenty of money. We don't need more money in the system. We need a better system. We need to eliminate waste and fraud and duplication and unnecessary overhead.
All right. Dr. Relman, we have a call from Brenda. Hi, Brenda. You're on Open Line.
Thank you, Doctor. You are such a breath of fresh air in this discussion. I have a question on diagnoses. A lot of people I have spoken to, patients, find that doctors are often not able to diagnose problems and do years and years of testing, and multiple doctors are seen before a solution is found, sometimes when it seems like it should be found sooner. Do you think better diagnostic skills, like doctors just really sitting down and talking to patients and listening and you know, drawing timelines instead of sending for CAT scans. Do you think this could help the system?
Yes, Brenda, I do. I think that you're right. Very often in our current healthcare system, patients are passed along from one doctor to the next and keep on being referred, and there's no integrated, organized, collective effort by doctors to get to the bottom of the problem. That is the beauty, that is the advantage of having group practices. I can assure you, at the Mayo Clinic, and at the Cleveland Clinic, and at the Marshfield Clinic, and Geisinger, and Kaiser, that doesn't happen. Doctors work together using the best available scientific information, working with their patients, with primary care doctors involved. You're quite right. Lots of diagnoses can be made right up front by simply primary care doctors carefully interviewing and examining their patients. I taught clinical medicine to medical students for many, many years, and my experience was that most of the diagnoses, even in difficult cases, can be made right up front by carefully interviewing and examining patients, even before you do lots of tests. And in a good multi-specialty group practice, that's what they do.
All right, Brenda, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Relman, also, can you comment on the provisions that have come up so far? One of them is that all individuals would be required to have health insurance. The other would be some sort of a healthcare exchange where individuals and companies could purchase, could compare and choose their healthcare coverage.
Yeah. Well, those ideas are based on the notion that we should start with the healthcare system that we have and try to improve it as best we can. And I suppose that's better than nothing, than doing nothing. But it's not going to solve the problem. The problem is that the system that we have doesn't work. People should not be required to take out health insurance and be penalized if they don't. Health insurance ought to be a right that everybody has. And everybody ought to be able to go to see a doctor of their choice in whatever group they want and choose whatever doctor they want to take care of whatever legitimate health care problems they have, as long as the whole system fits into a national plan, as long as we all agree on how much we want to spend and roughly how the money ought to be distributed, how much to medical care, how much to chronic care, how much to home care, how much to research and education and so on.
All right, and we have time probably for one more quick question. Tom, you're on open line. You have a quick question for Dr. Relman?
Yes, this is Tom, and I have heard many times from my doctors that part of their problem with the cost items and why it drives prices up is because of the being sued and the big lawsuits and the cost of the insurance.
Yes,
and,
yes.
They really say, you know, it my net after I'm done, why is very low. So
yeah.
Okay, let's let Dr. Relman answer because we only have about 2 minutes left.
Right. Well, that's a common complaint of doctors that the reason that medical care is so expensive is that they have to do lots of tests to head off possible lawsuits. That's a legitimate problem, but it isn't nearly as big a problem as is claimed. And people who looked into this have concluded that that's not really a major factor in driving up health care costs. However, that can easily be dealt with in a reformed health care system. First of all, group practice results in far fewer lawsuits because doctors are watching each other. They're peer reviewing. Doctors are practicing together in a group. That's the way they're taught medicine in the first place in medical school. And incompetent doctors and sloppy doctors are identified and dealt with by the group because they don't want to have any problems. And secondly, you could easily have a no-fault insurance system which said when people are really injured by exposure to the healthcare system, their costs and their legitimate injury should be paid, no questions about it, without regard to who was at fault. And then a separate system should be set up to deal with the doctors.
Dr. Relman, I hate to interrupt you, but we are out of time now.
Okay.
Our hour is up, but we want to thank Dr. Arnold Relman, Professor Emeritus at Harvard Medical School, former Editor-in-Chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, and author of a book called A Second Opinion, Rescuing America's Healthcare. Thank you for being with us on Open Line. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.